Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, Restoring Internet Freedom on Remand, Next Steps for the Federal Communications Commission. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Matthew Brill, a partner at Latham & Watkins, who is the global chair of their communications law practice and member of the Supreme Court and appellate practice. We also have Christine Hackman, a vice president of policy and advocacy at U.S. Telecom, the Broadband Association, Russell Hanser, a partner at Wilkinson, Barker & Naur, and our moderator, Mr. Lawrence J. Spiwak, president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies and a member of the executive committee of FedSoc's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Mr. Spiwak, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. We have a very interesting Teleforum today with a very excellent panel, so I'm very excited about that. Today's title, as the moderator said, is Restoring Internet Freedom Order on Remand, Next Steps for the Federal Communications Commission. So for those of you who probably, very few who are unfamiliar with the sordid saga of net neutrality litigation, let me just give a quick background to bring us up where we are. In 2018, the Federal Communications Commission issued their what's called the Restoring Internet Freedom Order, in which the current commission reversed the Obama-era commission's 2015 Open Internet Order. And in that order, in the Restoring Internet Freedom Order, the commission, among other things, primarily reversed the imposition of Title II common carrier regulation on the Internet and returned it back to a light touch under Title I. As with all major net neutrality cases, it was appealed to the D.C. Circuit in a case called Mozilla v. FCC. Making a very long story short, the D.C. Circuit, citing to its both the Supreme Court and its own past precedent, said that the commission, it was because the Communications Act was ambiguous, the commission was it was okay for the commission to reclassify broadband back to a Title I service. However, the Mozilla case was not a complete victory for the commission. Probably the biggest thing is the court adopted what I call, in a recent law review I did for the Federalist Society Review, I call the statutory abdication theory. What the court basically said is because the commission stepped off the Title II escalator, that's actually Judge Williams's phrase, because Title I is not an affirmative grant of authority, the commission has essentially abdicated all authority under Title II. So a lot of the issues involved are sort of in legal limbo. The result of that, which is not necessarily the topic of today's call, most notably, though, is the commission vacated the FCC's effort to do blanket preemption of all state regulation of the Internet. But it remanded three issues, two of which dealt with the statutory interpretation argument. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So the first issue they remanded was pole attachments. The second issue was whether or not by reclassifying could broadband exclusive providers. The second one is whether or not broadband could still be included in the FCC's Lifeline program. And the third one is more of a hortatory issue, which deals with public safety. So to discuss all this, as the introduction said, we have an outstanding panel. Matt Brill, his partner Latham & Watkins, Christine Hackman, who's vice president of advocacy over at U.S. Telecom, Russ Hanser is a partner at Williamson Barker Naur. All these people have extensive telecom experience. All of them have worked at the commission, and it's great that we're having them there. So let's get started. And again, there's a lot of stuff. If you review, people have reviewed the record in the that's been filed. I would say, you know, as usual, 97% of the comments filed don't go to the issues at hand. But we're going to keep to the issues on remand. So let's first talk about pull attachments. Again, quick background for those of you who might not be familiar. Under Section 224 of the Communications Act, the FCC regulates rates for pull attachments unless a state says they want to do it. And under the plain terms of Section 224, the only people that can take advantage of those federal rates are telecommunications companies and cable companies, although both the FCC and the Supreme Court said that mixed use is okay. So the court was concerned that with a return to Title II, broadband-only providers would lose, quote, key statutory rights to polls. And the court was rather dismayed that the FCC did a rather sloppy and inconsistent job of explaining themselves on whether or not 224 still applied or not. So they remanded it. So let's get started with that discussion. I will, through that, we'll start with Christine first. Christine, how should the court handle the commission handle the 224 issue?
Oh, man. I mean, and not speaking from the court's point of view, but I can tell you kind of how U.S. Telecom has been viewing this issue. And, you know, I really think you hit the nail on the head, Larry, by mentioning the mixed use, or what we've referred to as the commingling doctrine. You know, in looking at the type of folks that are attaching to the polls, you know, you find that the large majority really are offering either the cable service provider that you mentioned, or are offering some sort of a telecommunication service. So it's really not as glaring as an issue, I think, as maybe the court might have perceived it to be. But, you know, regardless of that, you know, when you look at the whole reason for the pull attachment rules was really to instill investment and competition in the market and allow access to that infrastructure. And, you know, their rules really are not being impacted negatively at all by the decision and Restore an Internet Freedom Order. In fact, the decision with the light touch regulatory environment in that order really is promoting that overall goal of those of that underlying pull attachment rule. So, you know, I think it's not really as big of a concern, and hopefully the court will be persuaded, or on the remand action, the commission will have all of that evidence in the record to move forward.
Hey, Russ, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so I first agree with everything Christine just said. I'd add just a couple of points. One is the court seemed to take the position, or seemed to act from the assumption that this was a statutory right that attachers, that broadband-only attachers had the whole time all along and suddenly lost with the release of the RIF order. That's not the case. So as the three panelists know, and as you know, Larry, for all but two of the last 25 years, the commission treated broadband as an information service implicitly and then explicitly for most of that time. And during that time, under the court's reading, broadband providers in their role as broadband providers did not have access. It was only the decision in 2015 that arguably changed anything. And all we're doing is going back to the regime now that we had been in for most of the history of the internet. That's point one. Point two is, you know, I find it really interesting. You know, the court suggests that the FCC failed to consider, or needs to better consider, the interests of the entities that are attaching and that might lose pole attachment rights. Well, the entities that are attaching are the service providers. They're the wireless providers, the wireline providers, and others who are seeking attachment to the poles. In other words, they're the ISPs in this case. And the ISPs overwhelmingly favored this decision, the RIF order. So if they're the ones who, in theory at least, lost rights, but they're the ones who favor the decision anyway, you have to ask, well, why would that be? And one of the reasons is the investment effects, which you alluded to, are overcome the disadvantages. So there's much more, ISPs are much more interested in having the incentive to invest and being able to invest and provide service. And they know that even if we shifted to an all broadband era, they could go and negotiate or could seek legislative outcome or something else. But right now, it says a lot that the ISPs are favoring this, even though they're the ones whose rights the court said may have been reduced.
Well, let me throw this question out to Matt. I did a little law review on this a couple weeks ago, and it seemed to me that exactly what Russ said, you know, this right was created essentially by the strokes of the pen in 2015 for broadband-only providers. And the court was rather adamant in U.S. Telecom saying, you know, to those people who thought you had a reliance interest, too bad. Is this, can the commission get away with just saying, hey, look, this is, you know, even the court said, you know, sorry, no reliance interest, you know. Is that a plausible theory for the court to go back on remand?
Well, I think fortunately the commission here is building a record that can bolster its reliance on the long history that Russ mentioned and the short period during which any reliance on the Title II classification may have been based. That long history is important. And I think from an administrative law standpoint, the FCC is justified in saying we can draw on the pre-2015 period of time, our experience and industry experience, and understand how broadband-only providers are affected. And it's relevant that there are very few broadband-only providers. It makes sense when you have the high sunk cost of deploying fiber or other infrastructure to offer additional services that garner additional revenues, including video and voice. So most providers, of course, do so. But, you know, now we'll have a record. And I've looked through the opening comments. I'm representing NCTA, the Internet and Television Association. And just as we hypothesized, there isn't evidence that any broadband provider has come forward and said, you know, I had some thriving business, but now I'm thwarted because I can't get on poles. It's not to say the pole attachment regime is ideal and is working great in every instance. There are certainly problems out there, but they're not problems created by a return to the longstanding information service classification. So notably, Google Fiber, which is a broadband-only provider, in its view, it claims it is not properly classified as a cable operator. It has said, well, there could be potential problems in light of this classification, but it notably hasn't said there have been any problems. So I think the record from wireless internet service providers, Google Fiber and others, at best hypothesizes that there could be isolated problems with pole owners, but there's no evidence that the classification is creating such problems, and certainly no evidence, as Russ put it, that any such isolated problems would outweigh the significant benefits of the light touch approach under Title I.
Well, let me follow it up because again, you represent the Cable Trade Association. You know, one of the things that I think that the court didn't ask in that is that why would somebody want to be a broadband-only provider? I mean, I think that's sort of a key question which the court just sort of ignores. And I think the answer to that, for those of us who've been practicing telecom law for many, many years, is kind of an obvious answer. And the court says, well, it's a demand issue. That's what consumers want. Well, maybe. But as you know, and as you've, I'm sure, litigated, you know, when you go with, you know, in telecom, it's you pick the legal regime which gives you the smoothest point forward. And so by being a broadband-only provider, that also then gets you out of local franchise requirements, telecom fees, all that kind of stuff. So it was it wasn't a government mandate that you should be a broadband-only provider, but it was a deliberate choice by a private firm. You have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it reminds me. I mean, my client, NCTA, came up with the phrase many years ago, rights and responsibilities, when first talking about IP-enabled services. When the FCC, in I think it was 2004, was asking about classifying voice over IP and other IP-enabled services for the first time, NCTA and others point out that, you know, when you look at the statute, any classification decision, whether it's for broadband or VoIP or IP video, has certain rights and certain responsibilities. Certainly, pole attachments is one of the rights that you can get if you're a regulated entity within the categories that the statute regulates, cable, TV, and telecom service. But providers across all of these services make decisions about whether the rights are worth the burdens and whether entry barriers and rate regulations or tariffing obligations on the voice side and others justify, you know, trying to live within that regulated category. So all of these classification decisions have some import, just as the Title II decision divested the FTC of jurisdiction over common carrier services. But here, I think there's an especially hollow argument that broadband deployment has somehow been harmed because we have data showing the opposite. And certainly entities like Google Fiber and others can choose to operate as cable operators if they want to avail themselves of the benefits that the statute gives such operators.
All right. Good point. Russ, anything else? Christine, anything else on this topic?
None for me.
Same.
All right. sexy topic of poll attachments, now we can conclude it. All right, and moving from the frying pan to the fire, Lifeline service. So again, here we have another statutory definitional problem. Lifeline was established to give low-income folks access to telecommunication services, I guess all the way back part of the 96 Act. In 2016, the commission added broadband to that. That was then upheld by the 10th Circuit in the case called NRA 5 FCC 11-161. And you know, when the title of a case is just the FCC's docket number, how huge that case must have been. So here's what's interesting. The D.C. Circuit's view was that reading the Communications Act, in particular 214 and 254, which is the statute that specifically deals with universal service, they argued, and I quote, broadband eligibility for Lifeline subsidies turns on common carrier status, close quote. So in the court's view, with the return to Title I, Lifeline could no longer include broadband. Again, we're back to the statutory definition problem. Now, what's interesting is, as support, the D.C. Circuit pointed to the 10th Circuit's opinion. In reading a lot of the record, people who say that Lifeline can be a broadband can be included in Lifeline also point to the 10th Circuit's opinion. So I guess as a starting point of our question is, who's right? Whose reliance is correct? So, Russ, you want to start with this question?
Sure. So, the parties who argue that you can use Lifeline to support broadband services are the ones who are right. And I think that the case you mentioned, the 10th Circuit case, which evaluated what's known as the USF ICC transformation order, that decision and the underlying order, I think, pretty clearly support the view that the funds can be used to support broadband service. So what happened then, we were in 2011, and the commission under then-chair Julie Chenikowski was interested in reforming a few systems, but among them the universal service systems in a way that could pivot them toward broadband. This is in the wake of the 2010 National Broadband Plan. And they adopted a theory under which it is true that the recipient of universal service had to be a telecommunications carrier, because there's a requirement that it be an eligible telecommunications carrier. And a telecommunications carrier is defined in the Act as an entity that provides a telecommunications service. So that's true. But then the FCC said that doesn't mean you can't provide money to support something else that entity is providing, namely broadband. And there's a lot of language in there's at least some language in Section 254 of the Communications Act, which is the universal service provision, that suggests Congress was thinking about possibly using money to support information services, or what are sometimes called advanced services. And that was the theory that FCC adopted then. It was in the context of high cost support, but it later moved on and applied this theory elsewhere, including to Lifeline. And that's the regime we have, and it was frankly a little bit surprising to me that the court in Mozilla went where it did, because it seemed to sort of be shorthanding it and not investigating exactly how the sort of statutory and policy argument played out before and why it didn't pose a problem here to reclassify.
Christine or Matt?
It's Matt. I mean, I would say I certainly agree with Russ. Part of this is easy. The statute has been definitively construed to allow support for broadband under the Lifeline program. And critically, that kind of support was established when broadband was an information service before the 2015 Title II classification. So there's no doubt we can return to supporting broadband, notwithstanding the information service classification. I think the real debate is the same as the one we just had with respect to poll attachments, namely, can broadband-only providers get support for Lifeline without also providing a voice service? And the answer to that may be no, but that again just raises the question of, well, what is the import of that? First, is there some real benefit that's being deprived to society because those entities couldn't get support without also providing a voice service? And there's no evidence of that. There are good reasons to provide voice service along with broadband. Most consumers want both, so it's pretty easy from a marketplace perspective to offer both as a condition of getting support. And even if there were a problem, does it justify solely for that reason, throwing out all the benefits of Title I and returning to Title II. Well, certainly it does not. So from the standpoint of my clients and my own views, this is a pretty straightforward issue, and it's one that the commission in a fairly narrow way can address on remand from the court's decision.
And Matt, to your point about, you know, consumers and what are consumers choosing on this, Free Press actually put in this record, and Free Press, for those of you that aren't familiar with them, are generally a group that are favorable of the Title II regulation and opposed the changes in the Restoring Internet Freedom. But they pointed out that only 1% of Lifeline customers are even choosing the broadband-only model. So going back to that point of the cost versus the benefits, in a 1%, in a world where consumers are already choosing both services, is it worth the commission abandoning all of the wonderful benefits that come with the light touch Title I regulation for just a 1% of consumer situation?
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. I actually, in preparation for the teleforum, went back and at least looked where the D.C. Circuit cited to the 10th Circuit's opinion. And they pointed exactly the point that Matt just brought up, was essentially broadband-only ETCs. And even the court said in that case, and I guess the commission said in the underlying order, then yeah, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, but that's not really before us there. And I think everybody's sort of the view is like, well, you know, all right, we'll worry about it then, but it's not really what's going on now.
Hey, Larry.
Yes, sir.
So this is Russ. Before we move on, I just want to touch back on something Matt said. Matt noted that it's possible that if we get to a broadband-only world, that those services would not be supportable, and I entirely agree with that. I just want to note the flip side, though. It's also possible that they could be supported. So whereas the Section 224 language we were discussing a few minutes ago is, you know, fairly straightforward and clearly governs, you know, Lifeline actually began in the 80s under President Reagan. It was codified, as you said, in the 96 Act, but the 96 Act includes a provision that also says nothing here is meant to sort of affect the collection, distribution, or administration of Lifeline program that pre-existed the 96 Act. Obviously, pre-96, we did not have a Lifeline program that supported broadband, but what that suggests is that there is an ability, there is some residual ability of the FCC to do something like a Lifeline program, even potentially outside of Section 254, but as I mentioned before, Section 254 has some language that can be read in various ways. So while I entirely agree, we might find out somewhere down the road that broadband only is not supportable absent an amendment to the statute, it also could be we'd find out the reverse.
That's a great point, Russ. And which brings me to just a discussion point. Again, it's not a really legal issue, but this being such a political topic, there are a lot of calls both in the record and just out in the echo chamber that somehow the FCC needs to completely revamp its Lifeline program, especially now that we're in the COVID environment. Is that appropriate for this particular remand, or should the commission stick to its knittings and just try to answer the court's decision, questions as best it can and move on?
Well, it's Matt. I'll start. I think it's certainly not appropriate for this narrow remand proceeding. We're going to have a really broad debate in the wake of the COVID crisis, and we are already having this debate in the midst of the COVID crisis about the public response, and a lot of it is a big subsidy debate. When we see so many Americans working from home, distance learning from home, obtaining telehealth at home, there's a fair debate about the role of government in subsidizing broadband access for people who don't have it, can't afford it, whether it's low-income support or high-cost support in rural and other unserved areas. But that's a pretty big debate about, you know, large-scale appropriations. We're seeing in the CARES Act funding roll out for broadband, and there are a lot of debates in Congress about additional funding for students to learn at home and again, for low-income support. So I think those are entirely appropriate debates, and when we're in the midst of a crisis like this, it makes sense to think about the role of government in supporting an essential service like broadband. But it's certainly not one that fits within the narrow remand from the D.C. Circuit, and it's just not something that the commission necessarily even has the funding or authority to tackle in this context.
All right. Makes sense to me. All right. Well, our first two topics now discussed. Let us turn to the third issue on remand, and that is the issue of public safety. This was, I think, a really interesting topic that I think surprised a lot of people when it came up. A lot of the state government, by way of quick background, a lot of the state government petitioners filed in the RIFO, and they made the argument that reclassification, and in particular the elimination of the 2015 no blocking, no pay prioritization rules, would somehow have severe implications for public safety, and therefore it was arbitrary and capricious. In fact, the exact quote was, you know, getting rid of these rules could, quote, imperil the ability of first responders, providers of critical infrastructure, and members of the public to communicate during a crisis. What's interesting about this is that the court's rationale for remanding this was that it pointed to 47 U.S.C. 151, which is the sort of very first section of the Communications Act, which sets up the commission, which is, you know, setting forth the purpose of the FCC. And in this case, the court pointed to the line, the FCC's purpose is, quote, you know, promoting public safety, life and property through the use of wire and radio communications. So in a way, this is a very hortatory mandate. But, you know, here we are. What's interesting is on appeal, a lot of people focus on the now infamous California firefighter example, where the bunch of firefighters, fire department in California, bought a Verizon residential broadband plan. And during the middle of the wildfires a couple years back, somebody in a low level in Verizon throttled them, and this has now caused celeb. So the court, I think, rather cheekily, you know, talked about this case a lot, but then said, well, this happened after the rule, so we're not going to expand the record. But clearly they mentioned, and I have no doubt that, you know, the record is now has the Verizon California case in it. So notwithstanding, the court was still very dissatisfied with the commission's treatment or lack thereof of the public safety. So this, I think, is one of the really big issues. So let's start the discussion, you know, have parties really refreshed the recollection sufficiently? You know, how should the commission respond to this? Chrissy, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. So just want to clarify one point. I think with that incident that you were referencing, and this kind of goes into a broader point that we're starting to see in the record as well, is that the service that was so taking it even a further step back, when you look at net neutrality and what we're talking about, we're really only talking about the broadband internet access service, the retail mass market service that you know, you and I would subscribe to most likely in our homes, and not the enterprise or specialized services. And with that incident that you described, I don't think that it was necessarily a bias connection, but I might be incorrect on that. But taking that to the broader level, when you really look at the type of services that first responders are subscribing to, they have unique needs that are different than what we need in our homes for, you know, watching videos or doing telework. And so in a lot of these instances, the types of services are enterprise services, or, you know, negotiated differently. So then that way the public service entity is able to get the type of services that they need. And those services have never been subject to the FCC's net neutrality regime, even under the more heavy-handed Title II approach in 2015. So, you know, when you're looking at the scope of this, you know, it's really important to keep in mind the type of services that these entities are subscribing to. And even if there are some public service entities that are subscribing to bias, you know, when you look at the overall positive impacts that this light touch regulatory structure has provided for everyone, it really does, again, show that the benefits of this regulation outweigh the cost. And nowhere, you know, in the record have we seen really a concrete example of this threat to public safety. But I would argue that right now we are seeing these networks being tested in unprecedented ways, in ways that we didn't really even have time to prepare for this particular crisis. But the longstanding light touch regulatory framework that has really allowed the internet to grow and evolve, has allowed internet service providers to be nimble and to make sure that their networks are able to respond to this increase in demand. And where they're not, or where there could be potentially concerns, we've seen providers out there adding capacity and making sure, in particular, that public safety entities during this time are not going to have to worry about their broadband connection when they're worried about keeping their community safe. So we've really seen, you know, providers being able to act quickly, and we've seen the ability of first responders and other government agencies to have these new innovative ways to communicate and share information that if this pandemic had happened even 10 years ago, you know, it would be just completely different. So, you know, I think we need to keep in mind the service and then also just the overall, what the overall regulatory environment has allowed broadband to allow us to do.
Russ?
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. And Christine ticked off a lot of what I would have to say, but I'll just say a couple of things. I want to comment on, I feel like this is not commented on often enough. I want to comment on the mildness of the remand on this issue. So on the other two issues, as we've discussed, the court essentially said there are these statutory provisions that seem to speak only to telecom providers, telecom service providers, and you didn't address what happens as we move toward an all broadband world. Here, it wasn't even that detailed. Here, really, the court seemed to be annoyed because, in its view, the FCC had simply not addressed the arguments of public safety entities. So public safety entities come in and talk about the reasons why they think that the action the agency is considering will undermine public safety. And when that happens, as long as they have material arguments, the agency does have an obligation to respond. The agency came back and said, well, we did respond because it was encapsulated in our broader response. And the court didn't agree and said, you have to talk about it specifically, in particular, when you have Section 1 of the Communications Act, which, Larry, you mentioned, which says that public safety is one of your overriding missions. So I don't see them as saying, we don't think this works, so much as I see the court saying, you need to explain to us, you need to address these concerns. And as Christine notes, there's a lot to say in response to those concerns. The Santa Clara incident had nothing to do with net neutrality. As Christine mentions, it was not a broadband, a mass market broadband plan, which is what was subject to the 2015 rules. I'd also say that the 2015 rules expressly allowed plans under which a customer would get a certain amount of data at a certain speed and then a different speed after they passed that data threshold. I promise it says that. It's in paragraph 122 of the 2015 order. So I think that those arguments are sideshows. What the commission needs to do here is come back, and exactly as Christine said, it needs to look at the broader environment. We're all using broadband more. Public safety is using broadband more. But individuals are using broadband more for public safety purposes, to check alerts, to find out you know, where it's safe to go and not to go, and so on. And the RIF order has had this effect of broadly expanding capacity, and broadly expanding capacity in a way that overcomes any hint of paid prioritization, which, by the way, I haven't seen any of in my 20 years or 15 years on this issue. So I think the FCC can really readily address the public safety point by saying, yes, we've looked at it, and if anything, this order has benefited public safety.
Matt?
Well, those are all great points. I might just take a step back and say, you know, when we think about regulations that are being called for, and some public safety advocates in California and elsewhere are saying we need to return to Title II to benefit public safety, you know, what is the need? What is the problem we're trying to solve? It seems that public safety advocates who call for Title II regulation are saying, largely, that broadband is critically important. On that, there's no dispute. Broadband is undeniably important. But they leap from that to what I think is a speculative and unsupported assertion that there are all kinds of harms that are likely to occur. That's the critical gap in the record. There aren't problems occurring, and it's not reasonable to assume that such problems would occur. And that some public safety entities have argued that, you know, throttling and blocking or paid prioritization are going to cause harms. But this does just mirror the larger debate about Title I versus Title II. And I think it was Judge Silberman who said there are vanishingly few examples of abuse over decades of experience. And the Santa Clara incident is really the only one that's been raised in the public safety context, and it's been thoroughly debunked as a basis for invoking Title II in this context. So I think when we think about, you know, what is the need for regulation here, we have a lot of really powerful rebuttals, and that the networks are robust, they're performing well, public safety users, like everyone else, are benefiting enormously from these networks, which are holding up well in the crisis. There's no reason to think there's going to be abuses. And if there were, contrary to the pledges of my clients and other broadband providers, the FTC could step in. So I think there's a broad array of responses that the commission is going to be able to provide that are very convincing, and I think no doubt should satisfy the task on remand.
It just seems to me like, isn't that what FirstNet's all about? You know, the whole purpose was a interoperable public safety network, which was created. Let me ask you just, Russ raised an interesting question, which is just sort of just getting back to the legal topic, which is what we're supposed to be talking about today. Russ, you described the court's response to the public on the public safety topic as mild. And you said that, you know, the public safety people had raised issues, and if I understand your characterization of the commission's response, they sort of, you know, just paid lip service, but really didn't get into great detail. In fact, I was rereading the case last night, and even U.S. Telecom had tried to come back and try and supplement the record, but the commission didn't do it. Let me just ask a question with regard to precedent and how the commission would be judged with its explanation. The public safety people say that it's arbitrary and capricious. I mean, how much deference? This is clearly sort of a hortatory question. I mean, it's sort of like, is broadband deployed on a reasonable and timely basis? You know, how much discretion does the commission have to go, look, I think I've answered this question, you know, that reclassification back to Title I will not have an adverse effect? Does this open up sort of, if the court says that's not enough, does this open up a future line of precedent where every commission order, you start going to the commission's mission statement as opposed to sort of the issue at hand? It just struck me before this, before we started on this call, that you know, hypothetically that could happen. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So I guess as a theoretical matter, could the FCC come back and say, nope, we dealt with that? I mean,
so
I guess
on remand and the court says that's still not enough.
Right. I mean, that could certainly happen, but I guess as a practical matter, if I were back in the Office of General Counsel at the FCC, where I spent some time too long ago now, I would certainly say, you know what, it's just easier to get to answer the question. And I suspect that if this remand is addressed, at least by the current commission, the course they will take will be to try to be as responsive to the court as possible and provide its thought process in some detail. You know, could they play chicken with the court and not do that? I guess they could, but there are cases in which judges will get annoyed and they could invite another remand. This is, of course, what happened before Christine was born, but in the triennial review remand process, you know, with USTA 1 and USTA 2, where, you know, it just appeared that Judge Williams, at least, was getting really annoyed at the FCC not being responsive to what he thought he was being clear about. So, could happen and could lead to a back and forth. My guess is that the FCC will try to avoid that outcome by addressing these points individually and clearly.
And let me jump in, Larry. It's Matt. I to the extent the question is if the FCC now provides an explanation as to why its Title I light touch regime adequately serves the interests of public safety along with everyone else, how much deference will it get? I think the answer to that is a lot, because this is really, I think, best viewed as a strain of administrative law cases where the D.C. Circuit just chided the FCC for a failure to explain and respond to the record on the public safety issues. But it's not demanding a particular answer, and we know that because the court didn't vacate. The court didn't think it was serious enough to undermine the Title I classification, even when they thought the explanation was inadequate. So the bar is fairly low in this context for the commission to come back with a cogent explanation under State Farm and other seminal administrative law cases. The commission doesn't need to have the best answer. It needs a reasonable and adequately explained answer. And I think this record provides ample basis to do that, and the commission can sail over that bar easily.
Thanks. All right. Well, those were the three major questions that we had. I'd like to use the time we have remaining for a section I'd like to call Update on the Case. So there's a couple of things that I think just where we are And that's why we're privileged to have the panel that we have. So here's the first question. Again, I don't know. This might be pure speculation, but petitions for certiorari of the original case are due, I believe, this month, unless they've been postponed due to the COVID virus. They're still due this month. Is that correct?
Actually, I think the Supreme Court delayed all deadlines of that sort. So I think we're now looking at a July deadline.
Yeah, July 6th. Technically July 5th, but that's a Sunday, so July 6th.
Yeah.
Shows you I haven't gotten out of my house since the crisis. Okay, so we have till July, so it's been moved back. But the petitions, let me rephrase, petitions for cert are due in July. Thank you, panel. Do we think anybody's going to file? And if so, on what issue? I know people are sort of keeping things close to the vest, but what do we think? Do we think people who don't like the reclassification decision might try and take up Judge Millay's concurrence? What do we think?
So this is Russell. Let me start. Well, first of all, let me just say I tease Christine about her youth because she's a client and we're friends. But I just want to make clear, Christine knows 10 times as much about all this as most people, 10 times her or 3 times her age. So let me just say that. And that's not because she shot me an email saying I needed to say that or anything like that.
Well, excuse you. At least Russ, you can say, hey, you kids, get off my lawn.
Right. Exactly. on your point.
I was going to say, I appreciate you thinking I'm as young as I really am not, but thank you. Thank you for that for that compliment.
So, on the question, I would say one unusual aspect of the case, which we haven't discussed, is this, you know, the fact that two of the three judges issued opinions that essentially said, we're finding that the FCC gets deference on this classification point because there's this 2005 Brand X Supreme Court case, but we really think that if the Supreme Court were to look at this now, it would find that there's only one way to look at broadband internet access, which is as a telecom service. Given those decisions, if I were on the side that wanted a Title II classification, I would think I would take up the invitation and file for cert, even if it put some other victories at risk, the preemption victory that they had. And the reason I would do it is because I'd be worried that if we don't have that, then every time the administration changes, we're going to go back and forth. Whereas if they win at the Supreme Court at that point, which I think is unlikely, but if they won at the Supreme Court at that point, then they'd have a Supreme Court ruling that under the current language, there was only one appropriate interpretation, which is theirs. So for that reason, I'm kind of expecting someone will file for cert, but I could be wrong.
And let's not forget that Justice Thomas a couple months ago sort of dropped in a concurrence dissent. I wrote Brand X and I would consider revisiting it.
Yes, although I'd say that.
There's that too.
Larry. What Justice Thomas said was about a different aspect of Brand X that goes to the interplay agency decisions and court decisions. In that case, you may recall the broadband classification issue had been decided by the Ninth Circuit in a case called City of Portland. And when the FCC came along with its cable modem order, the Ninth Circuit said, well, City of Portland controls, so broadband should be a Title II service under our own precedent. And what the first part of Brand X said is that the agency, in essence, can supersede the Ninth Circuit's construction because the Ninth Circuit said it was a Chevron Step 2 issue. It was one where the statute is ambiguous and therefore an agency can fill a gap. I think Justice Thomas was clear in saying he now has a different view on the roles of agency vis-a-vis courts, but it had nothing to do with the merits of the information service classification. And I don't think it tells us anything about what he thinks on that question. So, you know, I'm not going to predict what people are going to do. I wasn't sure there was a good reason to seek rehearing, and some of the petitioners did and predictably lost. Without dissent from rehearing, it's usually not a great candidate when the Solicitor General's office would likely oppose cert to file a petition, but certainly can't rule it out. I don't think the Thomas concurrence gives much hope for petitioners, and nor do I think there's a strong chance that the Supreme Court is going to overturn Brand X now that that's settled precedent.
Even on the speaking of Justice Thomas, he also issued the his statement about preemption by non-delegation. So, you think the preemption point might be taken up, or no?
Well, the government would have to petition for cert on that, and I don't know what the Justice Department is planning to do, but I don't think that's likely. One of the reasons I don't think it's likely is that The D.C. Circuit did correctly say that conflict preemption continues to apply, and that just follows from the supremacy clause of the Constitution. So if a state like California, which I'm representing the cable industry in challenging their own net neutrality mandates, you know, if California imposes obligations that are directly contrary to federal law, that are contrary to the information service classification upheld by the D.C. Circuit, that are contrary to the FCC's judgment in eliminating the general conduct standard and other rules, those judgments are able to be preempted under the conflict preemption doctrine and the supremacy clause. I think that lessens the need to go to the Supreme Court on this blanket preemption, express preemption theory. If we're going to get to the same result with courts invalidating state laws that contradict federal law, I don't know that there's a compelling reason to sort of test the limits and kind of doctrinal nuances of the preemption doctrines.
Well, that actually brings me to the next question. I'm so glad you raised that. We're very fortunate that you're on the call. As you said, you're actually representing the cable companies out in the California case. For those people who are unfamiliar with that subset of the litigation, right after the commission issued its 2018 Restoring Internet Freedom Order, is nature abhors a vacuum. California passed its own state-level net neutrality law. As soon as that happened, both the Justice Department and private parties, of which Matt is one, representing, filed suit, and the parties agreed to stay that litigation. And there's also a Vermont case as well, if I'm correct, stay that until the end of the Mozilla litigation. Matt, my question to you is, what marks the end of the Mozilla litigation? Because again, we've got the remand, maybe cert. What marks the end that those cases then start back up or not?
So there was a stipulation in California and similarly in Vermont that tied the stay of litigation to the litigation process in Mozilla. So it ends at its earliest if there's a decision not to seek cert in July. If that's the outcome and there's no cert petition, the California case would resume within 30 days thereafter, except if a preliminary injunction motion is filed. In that case, the case would remain the enforcement authority of California would remain stayed until the judge can decide that motion for preliminary injunction. It's a little bit different in Vermont, but to similar effect. All of this at the earliest could resume within 30 days of a decision not to seek cert in July. If there is a cert petition, the stay of enforcement and stay of litigation would continue until the Supreme Court either denies cert or in the event it grants cert, until the end of the merits phase of the Supreme Court. So at the earliest, you know, within 30 days of a July non-filing, or considerably longer if cert is sought or even granted.
All right. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Well, before we take some audience questions, at the end of any after school special, we always have the segment, which is, what have we learned? So we're kind of, again, at this point of the litigation, I'd like to sort of throw this out to the panel of what have we learned? It's been 3 years since we've had the Restoring Internet Freedom Order. I think certainly during this COVID crisis, we have learned that the internet has not collapsed, as everybody predicted, with returning it to a light touch regime. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be a political issue. We've already seen people talk about it. It will inevitably be. You have, as somebody mentioned on the call, two different judges that have essentially given roadmaps on how to go back. I'll throw this out. What have we learned, and where do we think this is going? Because it's wonderful as lawyers and academics that we can still have something to do on this topic. It does get a bit tiresome. So let's sort of talk about that for a little bit. Christine, I'll start with you, please.
Sure. So, I think what we've learned is that the commission has the legal justification to look at broadband under either lens, and we've seen a much stronger growth of broadband legally. Well, legally, the commission can look at it under either lens, Title I or Title II, but under Title I, we've seen much more investment and growth of the internet. And, this uncertainty of if there is a change in administration or anything that it could, as you said, it's a political issue, could change. And there's just a need for certainty, clear, defined rules of the road that would once and for all settle the debate that broadband does operate much better with a light touch regulatory structure, along with some basic net neutrality principles that everyone can get behind, with the no blocking and no throttling. So, you know, what that means to me is the courts and the agencies have been dealing with this issue now since 2005. And, you know, it's really time for Congress to get involved and once and for all settle this debate.
Hey, Matt.
Well, I agree with all that. I mean, in short, the sky hasn't fallen. The internet's working great. I mean, consumers were told there was going to be some disaster after the RIF order. There were a lot of scare tactics. The internet's better than ever and under incredible strain during the COVID crisis. Our internet services are robust and terrific. So that doesn't free us of this political battle. We're going to be debating classification, I think, until the end of time if there's no legislation. I remain hopeful that if we can cut through the politics around Title I versus Title II, there is broad consensus on what legislation ought to look like. The industry strongly supports bright line rules against blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization. So if we can find a way post-election to get past the sort of toxicity of some of the debate, I think there is a broad consensus on what the regulatory framework should look like. And if we enshrine it in legislation, we can stop debating classification.
Ross?
Yeah, I agree with all that as well. The one thing I'll add that I think I've learned recently is that there's still a great deal of misunderstanding in the public about the issues and about specifically what ISPs' incentives are and how ISPs are acting. The last thing I was really doing before the COVID clampdown started was going to a couple of states and testifying on some state laws. And of relevance here, there was a Connecticut state law and Rhode Island state law that were both in part net neutrality laws. And based on the discussions I had, you know, people looked really surprised when I pulled out and gave links to commitments that ISPs had made about what they would not do and how broad those were and, you know, how well that regime was working. They were surprised often to hear that there is federal enforcement. If ISPs, I shouldn't say when, because I don't think it's happened, but if an ISP were to break its commitment, there's enforcement mechanisms at both the federal and the state level, and that there's just not the bad behavior that we've been told time and again for 15 years is going to happen hasn't happened. And a lot of people don't know that, and I think that's leading to a lot of heat with very little light. So that is all the more reason for clear rules of the road via federal legislation and to end this ping pong and to provide clarity throughout the ecosystem.
All right. Well, let's throw it open if we have any questions to the audience.
We'll now go to the first question.
Yeah. Hi there. My name is Matt Preston. I'm a 2L at University of Michigan Law School. Thank you all for your time coming here today. I just wanted to briefly ask, absent a definitive answer, which doesn't seem likely from what you're saying on the Section 706 interpretation issue, what other I guess, mechanisms or arguments do you think would be feasible ending the Title I, Title II debate, either from the agency itself or interested parties?
Matt, or who wants to take that?
It's Matt. I can try. I mean, I think now that the current FCC took the position that Section 706 doesn't provide authority for bright line internet conduct rules outside of Title II, we're really left with a choice of the agency reverting to Title II, which it almost certainly would do in the event Biden wins the election, or Congress, preferably, in my view, coming up with an approach that doesn't turn on classification. Congress doesn't need to resolve classification to decide what rules it wants in place. So it's really, I think, either sticking with the current light touch approach, reverting to Title II, or legislation that maybe is the best of both, with some increased safeguards to enshrine commitments into law, but without all of the heavy burdens of Title II, which many of which have nothing to do with net neutrality, things like rate regulation and service quality regulation. So those, I think, are the range of options on the table.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, to underscore one of the points Matt made, the reason we're in this classification debate is because these classifications were invented in 1996, when, at least outside of university settings, virtually nobody had broadband other than dial-up, and people weren't thinking about this. So this is another area why federal legislation would be useful, because it would get us out of this construct that was never meant to apply to this set of services and has led to lots and lots of angst and lots of administrative costs on all sides.
Christine, you got something?
You know, I mean, going back to Russ's point about, you know, why we have this structure, when you look at when Title II kind of came about and Title II regulation, that was in 1934, when there was one monopoly telephone company. And when you look at the broadband market today, we see competition, I think, beyond which even the framers of the 1996 Telecommunications Act rewrite were able to, even envision. So, you know, 100% broadband is essential, and the current climate has really reinforced that. But just because it is essential doesn't mean that it needs to have this heavy-handed regulation that was really intended when there is not competition in the market. So I think when we're looking at it, and again, the reason that I agree with Russ and Matt that this, you know, is an opportunity for Congress to step in here, is we really do have this vibrant, competitive broadband market that has grown up under the 1996 Act, when broadband has by and large been considered a Title I information service.
And just to sort of add one last little thought to that, having written more law reviews on 706 than I care to think about, you know, I think originally 706, the way that the FCC first started to use it was sort of a form of what I would describe as sort of super ancillary authority. And that was the roadmap given in the Verizon case. I think had they stuck to their knitting, they could have done it. But because they opted for reclassification, I would submit, and I wrote a big law review about this called U.S. Telecom and its Aftermath. The 706, which is the court in Mozilla said, it's not an affirmative grant of authority, but actually give it more authority than Title II. And it became so abused that I think the current commission had no choice but to reduce it to being hortatory. And, you know, firms are not passive recipients of regulation. They think, you know, part of the problem is, you know, you have your choice. You can do Title I or Title II, and there's no sort of it's either all or nothing. And I think the court, my own view is, like, a lot of this could have been solved had the FCC followed the roadmap given by it would not have been entirely clean, but at least I think the court back in the Verizon case gave a roadmap. But we are long past that now, because this has now just become doctrinal religion. So, any other questions?
Looks like we have one final question.
Hi, it's Tricia Pauletta from Harris, Wilcher & Grannis. Thanks. You all have been great. It's been wonderful. Following up on Christine's mention of what might be in congressional legislation, I guess it's Matthews as well. I heard Christine say there's consensus on, you know, preventing throttling and blocking. I heard Matt add paid prioritization, but I know there's been discussion with, you know, 5G and network slicing that is a form of paid prioritization or could be. So, you know, where is industry on that, as from your perspective? Thank you.
Well, it's a great question and a hard question, because, you know, I think it's easy to say there's consensus against blocking and throttling. The companies I represent have run newspaper ads saying that. There's I think, a little work to be done on what a ban on paid prioritization looks like. Is it a categorical ban or a ban on conduct that is anti-competitive or unreasonable? And are we going to let the FCC define what that means? And then there's some other issues that have been fought about for a long time, like interconnection. Is the exchange of internet traffic going to be subject to regulation as it was under the Title II order, and as it is not at all under the RIF order? And, you know, so it's not that there's complete consensus on all this. I think, you know, 5G brings additional issues to the table, and then depending on how deep into these issues you go, you know, are we going to have specific federal law on zero rating and other practices like data caps? I think simple is better, and some bright line rules prohibiting blocking, throttling, and some form of anti-competitive prioritization are sufficient. But we're sure to have debate about so the remaining 10% of issues that probably remain in subject to good faith disputes.
Yeah, and I'll just clarify.
All right, Christine.
I'm just going to clarify. My perspective was really coming from my membership of wireline providers, Tricia. So it was a great question. And I'm very much closer to the wireline side, which is why I threw out the two examples I did and didn't get into some of the nuances as Matt described.
Russ?
Sorry, I was just, the only thing I wanted to add is, Tricia, your question really highlights another point, which we haven't mentioned here, but, you know, running through the net neutrality debate, prioritization of one form or another has been a part of virtually every communications protocol we have used in recent years. And prioritization is a very important part of network management. You know, your video needs to arrive with a little bit more speed and reliability than your email traffic and so forth. So there, in any time we talk about prioritization, we do have to talk about the standards that are being used and the protocols that are being used and make sure that we're drawing very careful lines.
And I would add on top of that, as much as we would love, it's become sort of political nomenclature to use the phrase no paid prioritization and no blocking. I think as all of my academic work has shown, I personally think you have a giant constitutional problem. It's a rate of no blocking is a rate of zero. And so how do you get a rate of zero? You just can't pick a rate. To me, that's a confiscatory rate. And as Russ said about paid prioritization, I mean, you know, even Title II doesn't go that far. Under 202. So I think there's a lot of problems. And as we all know, that once you codify something into law, it could be a very long time before it's changed. I mean, we're dealing with a law right now from 1934. I think we need a better standard, which is why, again, I kind of like the idea of the commercially reasonable standard. It's a little more flexible. The D.C. Circuit came up with in the data roaming order in Selco is one of my ideas. A lot of people have had that. So, but to be continued. Well, I would like to thank my outstanding panel. This was absolutely fantastic. Matt Brill, Christine Hackman, Russ Hanser. I want to thank everybody. I also want to thank everybody for tuning in. Hopefully it was educational. As I think one thing we came out of this is certainly to be continued, but we appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you at the next Federalist Society Telephone. Thank you so much.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Telephone, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.